Welcome to Wired on Development Interviews. Today's guest is Kim Barthel, an occupational therapist from Canada who is probably known best for her active work in the field of relational trauma. It's hard to sum up Kim's experience and expertise. My jaw was probably hanging open in awe for much of the interview as Kim casually mentions her vast and incredible connections and the work that she's doing. Kim's real strength, though, is her ability to make complex topics simple and reachable. You will come away from this interview with a deeper understanding of many different therapy approaches and a feeling that you could probably start to make headway with some of your behaviorally more complex kids. You can find links to all the good stuff Kim shares on the website, www.wiredondevelopment.com. And if you want weekly reminders of some of the seriously smart things that some of the brilliant clinicians I've interviewed have said, make sure you're signed up for Seriously Smart Snippets. Enjoy. Barthel, welcome to Wired on Development. I'm so glad you could join us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
I wanted to start off, like I always do, just finding out where it all started for you, when you decided you wanted to become an occupational therapist and your kind of journey up until now.
That question makes me smile. I have a very interesting story in that I decided I wanted to be an occupational therapist when I was 9 years old, which way back then was a pretty odd desire. But I had an aunt who worked in special education, and in the province in Canada where I lived at the time, there was only one occupational therapist in the whole province, and she worked with my aunt. And I thought, wow, this is the coolest job. And I had spent so much of my childhood and especially my youth working with people with special needs. And my interest was always mental health.
Why would you have spent your childhood working with people with special needs?
Well, you know, given the exposure that I had to my aunt's special school, and then I participated in Girl Guides, and all of my service was working with kids with special needs. And then I became a camp director of a camp for kids with special needs.
So was that before you became an occupational therapist?
Yes, I started when I was 14, volunteering, and then worked at camp until I was through university, which was at age 21.
Okay, that's such an interesting story. I had a similar story. I was working at a home at the time, you know, children with disabilities used to have homes that they stayed in. You know, those kind of institutions have been disbanded, but at the time when I was at school, they had a program for students that you could go there and sort of do activities with the kids. And I used to do that all through my summer holidays, and I loved it as well. I also knew from really early on that I wanted to work in pediatrics.
So we are both odd.
I guess we are. So who were your early mentors and influences?
Well, that's another very special question to me. I graduated from occupational therapy in 1984. And during my university years, I fell in love with sensory integration in first year. And in Canada, in the early 1980s, this was completely out there. Nobody was certified in sensory integration, especially in Western Canada, where I'm from. And so my very first placement right out of university, like 3 days later, was at the Ayers Clinic. So Jean Ayers, in the end of her career, was my first mentor.
That's amazing.
And so I spent, I guess it was almost 3.5 months at the Ayers Clinic. And at the end of my time there, she said to me, "Kim, you need to learn about movement." And I said, "Well, okay. Tell me what that means." And she said, "You need to study neurodevelopmental treatment." So my next project was to develop or to take my NDT certification course, which I did shortly thereafter. My instructor, her name was Hélène Larin. And Hélène Larin is one of the early American trained therapists from the BOBETs. So the Neurodevelopmental Treatment Association is the North American component of the development of BOBETH in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. So by 1984, SI and NDT were very profound in both of my right and left side of my brain. And you know, both of those areas became a significant influence in my career.
Yeah, that's a really good combination of skills to have.
Mm-hmm.
What did you believe then in your early years that you no longer think is true?
What a cool question. Oh my goodness. Well, I think, okay, there's two thoughts that come to mind when you ask me that question. One is philosophical. When I first began as a newbie, I had this perception that it was my responsibility to fix everything, that we were actually in this work to create profound change that would, I'm going to even say it, you know, cure or create such significant change for families with disabilities. And I think that over the span of, this is my 35th year as an OT, over the span of my career, I've come to be with the idea that healing is being in alignment with whatever it is that you're experiencing. And, you know, there was a big grieving process for me, probably in my early 30s, feeling like I was not really very effective as a therapist, that I was disappointed in what I was comparing myself to. And when I was able to let that go, my engagement in our profession has never looked back. And I think that was a significant turning point. So that's something I no longer believe is true. I do not believe that we are here to fix people. You know, we are in this work to support individuals in being the best they can be throughout their lifespan.
Right.
The second thing that I no longer believe is true is, as a person who has, I don't know, an arm's length worth of neuroscience postgraduate study, is that science is not factual. And that if I ever become attached to any of my literature review or research, I'm going to be in trouble. Because as a person who reads neurobiology in the bathtub, it changes every 5 seconds. And, you know, we're always learning, evolving, and gathering more knowledge that has really shifted and changed support for what we do in our professions of PT and OT.
Yeah, I think I read somewhere as well that you shouldn't sort of be an expert in a field for more than, I don't know, 5 or 10 years, because after that you become so attached to it, as you said, that you can't actually see the wood for the trees.
Yes. Yeah. And I mean, for me, for some of us, I think that is scary. For me, I couldn't be more excited. Because
right.
I'm always looking for new ideas, new thoughts, and that's what keeps me connected and engaged to the work, is the possibility of new learning.
It is exciting and challenging to kind of be constantly questioning yourself and questioning your previous beliefs. You still use NDT and sensory integration as your basis for what you do?
Well, yes and no. Okay, so I can answer those questions very elegantly. I am an instructor in both of those disciplines. Yeah. So I teach both sensory integration as well as I'm a neurodevelopmental treatment instructor. But in the past 17, 18 years, I would say that what I have contributed to our profession is a very holistic perspective, and developed an approach, I'm cautious to use the word approach, a philosophy called syncrasy, which is synchronized sustainable interventions for children and adults with special needs, which includes and integrates all thought processes as one way. So relational engagement, regulation through relationship, understanding movement, NDT is a part of that. Sensory processing intervention is what I call it, because SI, I'm a classic SI trained person. And, you know, AIRS SI requires a lab environment, a clinical environment. And I believe that our contribution in the world of sensory can be had in the grocery store, in the car, in the church, anywhere. Right. So I call it sensory processing intervention. And the neurobiology that sits behind all of the things that we do. So I would say that those are foundations that sit behind the scenes of my clinical thoughts and what I teach in our world, but not in a very classical or strict fashion.
Right, so they just form your baseline framework.
Yes.
So what sort of patients do you find challenge you the most?
Let me say, for me, and all those in the world that know me would smile at my answer, the more challenging the client, the more I love it.
Right.
From psychopaths to significant multiple levels of disability, all of it is interesting. The more severe the mental health issue, the more engaged I am. So what would cause me the most challenge? Probably a client who required a splint or a wheelchair, because I wouldn't have a hot clue how to do that anymore.
That was not the answer I was expecting at all.
If you asked me to make a hand splint today, I think I'd have a meltdown. I'm not sure that I would even know where to begin.
You bring many other strengths to your work. I was looking through your website, actually. I mean, you've just got a heap of stuff on the go and some brilliant workshops coming up. And the one that really caught my attention was the challenges of distinguishing between sensory, emotional, and cognitive components of behavior. So obviously, it's a whole day's worth of information. But I wondered if you could share what would be like a caveat or a take-home message that you like therapists who've done that workshop to go away with?
Well, I'll start by giving you a two-minute background on how I came to that awareness. Came from clinical experience. So coming to the clinical work with a very strong sensory background, because one of my very first clients was Temple Grandin, who is a very famous advocate for autism. And she was a patient client at the Ayres Clinic when I was a student there.
Wow.
And at the time, she was developing her hug machine. And, you know, those of you in the audience who don't know Temple Grandin, there's an HBO movie called Temple, which is her story of growing up as a person with autism to the multiple PhDs that she now holds. And she developed a device called the hug machine, which gave her proprioceptive input and decreased her anxiety. So in the early 80s, the idea that sensations, the fluffies in your socks, the elastic in your underwear, the tag in your shirts, could cause you an emotional response, that was as foreign as you could imagine. So in the beginning, all of my thought processes or my focus was around dysregulation from the sensory perspective and the body perspective. But I worked with street kids, drug addicts, prostitutes, kids with multiple challenges. And I had this one kid who was a street kid. He grew up in the streets of central Canada where it's 40 below in January. And at the age of 8, he was apprehended because he had been living like a feral animal on the street until he was 8. And then he came into care and he was in a classroom. And his teacher said to me, take him into your SI lab and do something with him. He has undiagnosed ADHD. And I had something to prove. I think I was about 25 at the time. And he was the kind of guy who was, he would have jumped out of an airplane. He was so intense. So in my SI room, he climbed the climbing wall, which was about almost 6 feet high, and then would dive into the foam pit. And he did that for about 45 minutes. And I just watched him do this. And at the end of that 45 minutes, he was lying on the mat in my clinical space with his hands behind his head and looking kind of contemplative. And I was proud of myself because he was still and, you know, present in his body. And he went back to the unit where he lived and tried to kill himself.
Right.
And this was a wake-up call for me. It was my wake-up call of how similar trauma can look to a neurological process that we call sensory integration disorder, dysfunction. And, you know, this little guy didn't succeed in killing himself, but what he taught me was, you know, he sort of crashed into a present state in his body, and that's where you remember and you process emotion is in the body. And he felt and remembered all the crappy things that had happened to him in those 8 little years. So I began my neurobiological study of the brain, especially the amygdala, and I found that the amygdala, which is what creates our emotional states, it relies on sensory processing as its data. So every sensory experience is an emotional experience. They're not separable. So I thought, okay, if I'm going to treat the sensory systems, I also need to appreciate, how am I going to regulate the emotional system? This is my psychotherapy skills. I need them together. How I'm going to relate to this person, it can't be one way. So then there's a third part to this story. I worked with a young man who was Canada's youngest psychopath. At the age of 3, he murdered his parents. He lit their bed on fire and planned how he was systematically going to light the house on fire. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when he called, he dialed 911 to tell the police what it looked like and felt like and smelt like to watch them burn. So he was affectionately, you know, everybody was terrified of this little guy who was in baby jail for most of his childhood. And he became my client at the age of 9 because he showed a lot of self-abusive behavior, things that we see in kids with autism, rocking his body, banging his head, picking at his skin. And the psychiatrist working with this guy at the time said to me, "Kim, you know all those weird things you do with kids with autism? And they feel better. You roll balls on top of them. You put them in swings. You do all these quote-unquote weird things. They calm and they are present." And it was cool that even back in, you know, late 1989, that was observable. And so I said, okay, I'll try and work with this kid. And, you know, one of the things that happened for me in my experience with him is the more present he became in his body, the more disordered his mind became. So one thing that led me to understand is the effect of cognition, the effect of executive functions, the effect of the frontal cortex on regulation.
I'm not entirely sure I understand what you mean when you say the more present he became in his body, the more distorted he became. What did that actually look like?
So, you know, one of the fun things that I love to tell about this story is that the team, when they asked me to work with this kid, the team said, as if this is going to be useful in any way, shape, or form. And that made me want to try even more. But one thing they told me is you cannot let him see you be afraid. Because if you are afraid, you're done. So I practiced for 2 weeks looking in the mirror, trying to be cool. And I walk into his cell and he says to me, "Get out of my mind. I can feel you in there." And all the hair went up on the back of my neck and hair stood up on my arms. And I thought, I'm done here. And then he leaned right into my space and he said, "Your eyes just went black." Oh. And he was reading my pupils dilate. So I thought, okay, I have a choice here. I can either lie and then I will have no relationship, or I can tell the truth. And I said to this guy, "You're right. I'm scared to death of you, but I'm also very curious how your mind works." And I said it just like that. And we were instantaneously friends. And he let me do anything, basically. Roll the ball on top of him, put him in the swing. He was in. And the very first time we did any kind of deep pressure, heavy work, you could see the change in his body. His shoulders relaxed. His eyes softened. He actually sat down because most of the time he would pace like a tiger in a cage. And then as we sat down on the floor and started to draw, he started to tell me how he was going to cut me into little pieces. But there was a difference in his eyes. It was real. And I realized that the more organized he became in his state of arousal, the more dangerous he was.
Right.
And so I went back to the team and I said, that's the worst idea we've ever had. Getting this guy regulated is going to make him a more functional psychopath. Oh, and of course, nobody had ever thought about that. So I worked with this kid. I still work with this kid. He's now in his late 20s. And we programmed the living daylights out of his mind. We made all of his scary thinking normal. We gave him other things to think about. He had 142 IQ. And he wasn't doing anything, really. So cognition is a big part of how we regulate ourselves, you know, how we calm. We try to calm ourselves with our mind. That's the poorest way to try. But we also dysregulate ourselves with thinking. And so the brain has taught me is that regulation is a three-part process. What I think about, how I organize my feelings, and how I ground myself and what I do with my body and my senses. And that's why I spoke earlier about this integrated approach, that if we just do one thing, we are not meeting the needs of the individual client.
What you're saying then is that there's not one thing that's driving behavior. There's the combination of all those components, and you have to address each of them.
You got it. One course that I teach is called Becoming a Behavioral Detective, which is very focused on helping not just therapists, teachers, parents, social workers, correctional officers, forensic psychologists, in an analysis process of looking at all the different driving forces that sit behind the scenes of why people do what they do. And just to finish a final thought, you know, I developed the mental health system here in Canada for our Inuit people, which are the Canadian Eskimo mm-hmm. people. And they have the highest rate of sexual abuse in the world, and the highest rate of suicide in the world. And so when I moved to the Arctic of Canada in the late 1990s, I began to study the field of attachment. And I would say that has become probably the greatest focus for me, attachment and trauma, since 1996. And that helps me really understand the emotional component of this picture. That was a long answer to your question.
Probably creates more questions than answers, but I think that's the whole point of doing the workshop and getting a lot deeper into it, doesn't it?
It is.
Yeah.
And, you know, I have this really beautiful opportunity right now, for example, where I'm working with a center in Central Australia, which, by the way, I had a job in Central Australia for early out of graduation. I worked in just near Alice Springs, developing services for Aboriginal people's children. And, you know, the whole Central Australia project that I'm helping out with right now is based on this thinking of putting these pieces together with respect to kids with trauma and special needs.
So the attachment and the emotion and the cognition, those pieces.
And the sensory. You know, I mean, think about both a living environment or a teaching environment. You know, there is this component of understanding all aspects of sensation as to how that contributes to either regulation or dysregulation. You know, every single situation or program develops the opportunity to have a full analysis of all of those pieces.
So you're working on that program with who?
There is a private clinic in Australia, outside of Sydney, who has started this collaborative process. And I find myself participating in all kinds of interesting projects globally. And this is a recent one.
So what does the program actually look like?
So it's a school, but it is also a community-based process to try and support youth who have multiple complex challenges in fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, drug and alcohol use, trauma, so that they have multiple complex comorbid challenges. And it's developing curriculum, developing environment, developing skills for staff, and also looking at community-based support. So it's kind of a wraparound system that they are looking at creating in that context. And I brought Australia up because I know that it's somewhat close to you in geographical location.
Yeah.
But there are many, many programs like this emerging all over our planet right now.
It's not a program that's integrated into a school. It's a school that's specifically developed around this need.
Exactly. And that's another trend, by the way, Mindy, that's happening, is less and less inclusive education in some situations and more specialized programming. And one of the things that I got to do a month ago was I was in China, where I've been going for the last 10 years, and supported the government of China in looking at universal design for learning curriculums for special needs children in education in China, which children with special needs have never been in schools, especially in inclusive schools. And so there is a conversation, there was a conversation in China about who belongs in inclusive programs and who doesn't. And this is becoming more common where there's a split in the systems because of meeting individual needs. And so different governments and different countries do things differently, but there are more and more special programs, in my opinion, arising across our world to meet the needs of kids who have more complex challenges.
The pendulum has swung, hasn't it? But it's gone from inclusive of physical disabilities to being specialized around behavioral.
Definitely. When I started, everybody had cerebral palsy. And now there are hardly any children with cerebral palsy. And it's, you know, autism and challenging behavior is the issue of the day for sure.
So when you first start working with a child, what are the core things you want to know about them?
Well, the very first thing that I do with anyone is watch. Observation is rich in providing significant amounts of information and data. And I actually call the process tracking. So I look a lot at action, behavior, movement, engagement in relationship to the environment that the child is in. Now, I mean, I do have some standardized assessment processes in my repertoire. I'm very, very interested in eyes and vision, how the child's visual vestibular skills support or don't support their postural system or their capacity to focus and connect. So I look at and observe and the context always drives my assessment. I'm a true occupational therapist at the core of my cells. So function and context are really important to me, and the desire of the client and their family. So, you know, what I see or what I might want, if that's not important to the family or the child, then it becomes, I reframe it in a way that I pull in whatever it is that we observe into what the family is hoping to achieve in their goals. So I look at movement, I look at posture, I look at arousal, I look at engagement, I look at sensory skills, and I look at functional participation. Sounds like an OT, right?
No, I don't think so. I think it sounds like a holistic therapist. Because I think all of those components are important for everybody to be looking at. I guess the differentiation between OT and PT then would just be what, maybe where your main focus is.
Mm. Well, and I think, I mean, as an NDT, NDT gave me a tremendous, tremendous sense of pride and conviction in teams. You know, having worked in so many places where there are A, no therapists, or B, very, very, very limited numbers of therapists. Like China only has 9 registered OTs for the whole country.
Wow.
So, you know, transdisciplinary, I use that word, transdisciplinary models of care are very important to me.
Yeah.
And, you know, each one of us bring to our practice our own passion, as well as our own orientation based on our training. You know, whether I'm a PT or an OT, I bring my own history of what it is that I've learned, and I might use the same frame of reference, but have a different angle on it. So, you know, in our 8-week NDT courses, we have speech, OT, and PT all together, all the time, for 8 weeks. And we each put our own discipline, you know, on top of the basics of the frame of reference.
Yeah, that's a lovely way to explain it. Kim, I might just jump into some of the questions that therapists have posted. So the first one was from Ellen. It says, I'm interested to know about the evidence behind craniosacral therapy.
Well, I wanted to cry when I read that question, because I think there is any evidence for craniosacral. But I looked at, I did a Google search, a Google Scholar search before our conversation here. And there was, in 2012, was the most recent sort of lit review about craniosacral, and the evidence was very limited. I have my own theories as to why I think it works or doesn't work. I think it has a lot to do with touch, the impact. I have a lot more scientific evidence for touch in my repertoire of knowledge. And I think it has a lot to do with, especially when we're talking about cranial bones, all of the tiny vascular systems and tiny cranial nerves that exit through the cranial bones, that as, you know, alignment, especially at the occipital base, is improved, you have more potential for capacity of ease. That's the way I want to say it. You know, as a recipient of craniosacral, more than a provider of craniosacral as a standalone treatment, it creates such a sense of regulation within the system. But I think it has a lot to do with touch. That's my opinion. But cranial, for me, sits underneath everything. I don't think I'm ever not using it. It's always there as an aspect of the quality with which I touch a person.
So craniosacral's been around, and I've kind of bumped into it on and off over the years, but I'm not, and I had a really brief sort of 1-hour introduction to it, which probably isn't the best way to get an understanding of something. So just on an actual application level, is craniosacral therapy when you're actually just having somebody lying down and placing your hands, you know, on the head or on some other body part, or is there more to it than that?
See, it's even hard to ask the question, isn't it?
Yeah.
I know. Well, okay, so let me back up a tiny second here. As an NDT instructor, one of my mentors was a lady named Reggie Bain. And Reggie is now passed on. She was a very incredible, amazing NDT OT instructor who also had polio. So she treated kids with significant disability as a paraplegic, and was probably the biggest game changer in my career. And for her own body, she started to take the work of John Barnes' myofascial release in the early 90s. And so I became very well versed in myofascial release. And working for John Barnes, I ended up doing some clinical work for him in the pediatric part of his clinic. He required that all of us who worked with him have cranial sacral therapy. And part of the reason for that was to increase our proprioception in our hands.
Right.
Because if you're going to be a body worker, you've got to know what the heck your hands are doing and feeling. And the intuition of your hands has to have a cortical cognitive component to it. And so craniosacral is a very fine palpation of tissue. That when you put your hands on someone's body, you can feel with your fingers, joints, muscles of your hands, where they are tight, where that body is restricted, and where that body is mobile. And craniosacral, I would say, is the finest tune tuning in, myofascial would be the next level, and NDT would be on the top of those three hierarchies. So as an NDT instructor, I would say my craniosacral palpation learning made me a better NDT therapist. And you learn to really feel into a person's body with your hands, whether they're stiff or loose, and how that relates to their structure and their skeleton. That's the best I think I've ever explained that, by the way.
I just thought that was an awesome explanation. So thank you, because it's probably something that kind of scratches my subconscious all the time. So that's been really useful. I love that. Shall we go on to the next question then?
Sure.
So this is from Kathy. Can you give us some guidance when working with families and children who have intellectual disabilities or communication difficulties and have been traumatized by their previous intervention? How can we best support growth and educate or attune to families to signs of distress? What type of intervention have you found is supportive when medical intervention has traumatized this same population?
This is such a beautiful question. And, you know, obviously inherent in this question is a specific experience. And I use a word all the time in anything that I do, which is attunement. And working with trauma clients of any kind, medical trauma being no exception, requires careful and safe attunement on the part of anyone who engages with a child or an adult or a family. You know, I mean, anytime there's trauma to a child, there's trauma to a family. And so as a therapist working with a child who has experienced significant trauma in a medical system, it takes time to develop a relationship. And I know that sounds fluffy, but I cannot speak enough about safety in relationship as to what that does to the nervous system. Decreases the sympathetic arousal, decreases cortisol, allows the vagal system to work better, allows the child the ability to, it changes the postural system. Safety and calm has a profound impact on our entire being, from cells to behavior. And really, the fastest way to create regulation for anyone is relationship. So I can give you an example. I worked in Hurricane Katrina after this profound disaster in New Orleans in the United States. And going back and forth from Canada to New Orleans, my friends would say, what does an occupational therapist do in a trauma, in the middle of a hurricane? And I would say, I hold a lot of hands. And they would say, well, that doesn't seem to be so special. It's huge, hugely special. Because the number one mitigating factor to post-traumatic stress disorder is who's there at the time of a trauma and what state they're in. So if you have somebody available to you who is calm and present and regulated when you're not, it's like a tuning fork. It shifts all the resonance in your nervous system and in your being. And with practice and repetition, it can gradually allow you to feel increasingly safe in your environment. So it's about having a relationship.
So taking the time to develop the relationship through being just calm and present.
Yes, and you know, so often we get very focused on our goals and objectives. And many of us throughout the world, our funding for providing clinical work depends on that. And sometimes that can be the biggest deterrent to getting anything done, is the pressure to get something done. And if I can be available and present, I often can get so much more done. And there's more that comes to my eye and my awareness if I don't have an agenda. And I think that takes some experience to get to that place. I know that when I was a new grad, I used to come in with my list of all the things I was going to work on in that session. And now I don't even think about anything before I walk in to be with a client, other than clearing my mind and my being so that I can be present. And then everything reveals itself for you.
Yeah, I think that you have to go through that journey, though, don't you? You have to start with your list so you can develop the background skills before you can let them go.
Yep, you do. Because you don't. Because I know. You don't know. I sure didn't know what the heck I was doing. And it takes time to develop that awareness.
Okay, so the next question from Meryn says, as a physiotherapist relatively new to working with students with autism, where would you suggest we start with this very mobile population?
Relationship. I'm going to say it again. The biggest complaint, I teach NDT for autism. Okay, so I have a course, neurodevelopmental treatment in the treatment of autism, which is hands-on with kids with our highly mobile. And the number one complaint I hear from the physios is, I can't get this kid to do anything for me.
Right.
They don't cooperate. They don't sit still. They don't participate. They don't engage. And without finding some way to jointly connect with a person with autism, you have nowhere to go. So it doesn't matter whether you're a physio or a teacher or a parent or a speech pathologist. We all share the arousal system. I have to have a kid in a just right state. So you might be a physio in an SI gym where you've got a kiddo in a Lycra swing where they have enough proprioception in their experience that allows them to stay in one spot for 5 seconds. And then you put your movement goal on top of it. Say you want to move on coordination, you want to work on coordination, or bilateral integration, or you want to increase an inner core activation. You have to scaffold those things together. You know, you need to have the ability as a physio to connect with a child, to attune, and to get them into that just right state. And then your movement goals become possible. Lots of times I chase, you know, I'm doing hands-on things with kids who are highly mobile, and I got to be highly mobile. Or I create activities that are way up high off the floor so that they can't get away from me. You know, or I'm very creative with the use of my equipment. Or if I have no equipment, you know, lots of times I find myself in places like, you know, the savannah of Africa or leper colony in India. I don't have any equipment. So I have to be very creative in what's in my environment that is going to give me my movement goal, which relies on my capacity to analyze movement.
So developing relationships with kids with autism, if you're not experienced in that sort of thing, is quite tricky because your usual sort of relationship skills are not effective.
Yeah. You have to be willing to follow. So whatever, you know, what we know about the brain is that if something is interesting to you and I'm interested in what you're interested in, we are connected. And, you know, for some kids that's lining up their cars or, you know, spinning objects. I have to find a point of entry where we can relate. And so I have to watch what's interesting to you. What makes you engage, what makes you connect with your world, then I got to go get you. And then once I've got you or I follow you, then I want to change it up. I call it sabotage. So, you know, if you're lining up your cars, maybe I put one that's kind of out of order. And then I watch, wait, and wonder and see what is it you're going to do when I create some change? Are you going to correct me? Are you going to get mad at me? Are you going to follow me? And so it's a process of, you know, connecting through interest and then scaffolding it to a higher level. And sometimes that takes a while and sometimes it takes 5 minutes. The other thing that helps kids with autism, especially kids with autism that don't talk, is to speak or narrate for them using what I call declarative language. So you're speaking as if you were the child themselves. So I would say to the child, you really like it when I do that. Or, you don't like it. when I move that car over here, you don't like that. And the use of my voice is very helpful in both regulating the child, but also in helping the child feel understood by me. And so we're actively, you know, putting that relational piece into whatever skill I want to teach.
That's awesome. Okay. So the next question from Emily is, what do you think the percentages of children with sensory processing disorders? In Australia, lots of OTs solely treat this way, and I feel lots of the times these children are not improving and their parents are reporting no improvements. Is this framework for a small percentage of children? As a physiotherapist, we are very functional and use evidence-based practice in our treatment. I am of the understanding that there is not much evidence for sensory integration training. Is this correct?
Yes and no. I mean, there are multiple things in that question, inherent in that question. So let me say this first. I'm in the final stages at this moment of writing a chapter on evidence-based practices in early intervention, which means that I've had to read every article known to man for the last, you know, written for the last 10 years on every form of early intervention practice that exists. It's been a great experience in that, you know, makes you open-minded.
Right.
And you would be very surprised how much evidence there actually is for sensory integration. I think that usually I'm asked that question more with respect to NDT than I am to SI, because there's more evidence for SI than there is for NDT. But
really?
Yeah, definitely. But the evidence is, first of all, better than you think. But based upon this conversation that we've just had, you can already tell that I don't believe one way is ever the way. And so, you know, inherent in the question is an exclusive practice the best practice for a child? In my professional experience, the answer is no, because there are so many reasons why our brain works the way that it does. And as a neurobiologist, I would say that, you know, there's so many overlapping brain parts in multiple disorders that are present, that the diagnosis is often really not that helpful to me. You know, if you come in with some label, it doesn't really tell me what's going on in your individual brain. So, you know, treatment protocols are not going to give me the meat and potatoes of what it is that I'm going to want to see with respect to an individual child. I really kind of have to take that label and shelf it, for example, and watch the individual child's performance. And that's how my treatment unfolds, rather than some diagnosis or some kind of particular frame of reference.
Yeah, that's a brilliant way to put it. I mean, I think even just the labeling itself is very subjective. You know, ADHD or behavior or sensory integration processing difficulties, it all overlaps and interrelates and really just is dependent on who's diagnosing.
For sure. You know, the other part that's inherent in that question that I want to comment on is as a consultant to the World Health Organization, we are now using a term evidence-informed practice rather than evidence-based practice, because we are humanities, science in the humanities, especially in the field of mental health, recognizes that the traditional form of scientific inquiry, evidence-based, doesn't always apply to human behavior. So evidence-informed practice goes to the scientific literature as informing our practice rather than throwing out things that may not have evidence, but allowing us to stay curious and objective about our practice. And because if we throw things out that don't have the quote-unquote ABA style of evidence and, you know, provision like a drug trial, we may be missing significant aspects of supportive intervention.
So the last question was my question, actually, and it's, can you give us some tips for working with children who feel threatened by changes to their established movement patterns?
People ask me all the time, what do I do with kids that I can't touch? You know that in my career, there's only been about two kids I couldn't touch. Seriously. It's not do I touch or don't I touch, but how do I touch? Where do I put my body? how far am I in their physical space? Do I come close? Do I come in front? Do I come to the side? Do I touch their hand? Do I touch their head? Do I put my hands on their body? It's the fine-tuning of that process that allows me to get into that system with safety. The two children that come to mind, they were both highly traumatized children, and it actually was not appropriate to touch them. But, you know, whenever we change someone's postural set, for example, if I change your alignment, I change your breathing. And that can be scary as all get up. You know, if I'm a little one with very, very low tone and I have difficulty staying up against gravity, and I'm using my diaphragm to hold myself up against gravity, and all of a sudden I have a new way of staying put, my breathing will change. And that changes my entire autonomic nervous system. So you can see fear as a result of movement for sure. And it's being able to stay regulated yourself when somebody is afraid. So I always say, I can't regulate somebody else if I'm not regulated myself. But I will comment on it. I'll say to the child, ooh, this is really hard for you. I can see that, and I do this to the preemies and the isolettes. The nurses think I'm a nut job. I say to the little preemie, I say, oh, that's really hard for you here. Look at what happens when I put my fingers here. Your breathing gets shallow, and you know, being in this position is really hard for you. So I'm tuning in at multiple levels, and you know, using tone of voice, facial expression, how I hold my head, all of that is processed by the brain in an eighth of a millisecond, the amygdala especially, and it helps soothe the brain. So I put those together. And so if you're working on movement, and a child becomes afraid or resistant, you have to be able to stay with them in that resistance.
Yeah. I think I've found over the years that when I'm having a bad day, I don't get anywhere with any of the kids that I'm working with.
I can relate to that too. Yep.
I would like to ask you your best advice to new therapists starting out in pediatrics.
Stay curious and be kind to yourself. Because most of the new therapists that I teach, they never feel good enough. And they always feel apologetic for the clients that have them. And they feel like, oh, I'm sorry that, you know, you don't have someone with more experience. And one thing that I would say is you already know more than your clients do. And so, you know, allow yourself that space to be a learner as a new grad and stay curious and patient with yourself.
And what frustrates you about current beliefs and practices?
Definitiveness. That's an interesting answer that came out of my head. Whenever somebody has a belief that is definitive, you know, when they're stuck in one perception and unable to have a conversation about another possibility, I would say that requires it requires more mindfulness from me, where I have to regulate myself better, and gives me a chance to unhook from wanting to convince people. How's that?
That's good. So what are you most excited about right now?
Trauma, unquestionably. I eat, sleep, and breathe trauma. And, you know, just came back last week from, I wrote a book with a very famous Canadian hockey player who was sexually abused by his coach as a young man. And we wrote a book called Conversations with the Rattlesnake. And we have been from one end of our country to the other, from Victoria all the way to Newfoundland, speaking across our country about mental health and trauma. And every year in July, we have a Victor Walk. So we walk a particular province. And this year we did, I don't know, maybe 200 media interviews and 7 different rallies and talking about trauma. And so for me, that is where my biggest passion comes into play. And in that topic, I put together everything that I already talked about, the body, the mind, the spirit, the heart, all of it together, as the way that think about how we support individuals who've experienced anything.
Last question then is best books and courses that you would recommend.
What would I like to learn? Well, I'm on fire about attachment. So one conference that is coming up this year that I think would really help anybody who's interested in that topic is called Attach. And it's in Denver in October. And, you know, some of the most famous people in that field of looking at trauma and attachment will be present at that particular conference. I still think that a neurodevelopmental treatment course is a good basis for anybody who wants to learn anything about posture. So I still feel that's a good path. It doesn't have to be an 8-week course. An introductory course allows you to look differently at how people move and how it relates to typical development. It's very biomechanical based. I think it's a good foundation.
And your sort of best book to have in your back pocket?
We were just commenting as we came home here, I have about 3,000 books in this house. And we were just thinking about, what are we going to do with all these books? Right now, one of the ones that I love is called The Body Keeps the Score. And it's written by Bessel van der Kolk. And it's about putting these pieces together that I'm talking about. The body, the emotions, the mind. And it applies to both people who experience mental health issues as well as children with autism. So that might be a good read.
So just if you could tell everybody where they can find you online.
So you can find me www.kimbarthel.ca. That's my website. And my website links to everything. My Facebook page, my Twitter page, Conversations with a Rattlesnake, as well as my YouTube channel. So I would say that kimbarthel.ca is the best way to find me. And those who are interested in Conversations with a Rattlesnake, it's also available www.conversationswitharattlesnake.com. And it is now available also as a Kindle. Theo and I are in the process right now of writing another book called The Power of Me Too. And I myself am writing a book called Decoding Autism, which is all about genetics, neurobiology, immune system, and the microbiome as it relates to autism.
So I can understand where your time constraints come from. I don't know where you fit this all in.
My short, you know, sleep time, I'm doing lots of other cool things when I'm not sleeping.
Well, Kim, thank you so much for your time. I really, really appreciate you sharing all your knowledge and experience with us.
Thank you, Mindy, and thank you for asking me. And it's such a joy to connect with you on the other side of the planet.
I hope you enjoyed that interview as much as me. If you have any questions for Kim, please email them through to me to collate. Kim has kindly agreed to answer a few more questions in the clinical corner on the Wired on Development website. That's www.wiredondevelopment.com. That's also where you'll find the email address if you need it. Your feedback keeps me smiling, so please also feel free to leave a comment on the Wired on Development Facebook page or send me an email. Cheers.